Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which is part of the New Books Network. Thank you so much for joining me today, and I hope you are safe and well wherever you are. Today, we are joined by Dr. Richard C. Jankowski, who is an associate professor at Tufts University, and we're discussing his new book, Ambient Sufism, Ritual Niches, and the Social Work of Musical Form, which was just recently published, so in 2021, with the University of Chicago Press. So fresh off the press. The book is an ethnographic study of the sonic and ritual landscapes of complex religious communities in Tunisia, using theoretical approaches of ethnomusicology that attends to questions and patterns of form, texture, and intensification of the soundscapes, such as during a trance or dhikr, along with the consideration of the uses of various instruments. The study illuminates the role of women and racial and religious minorities in shaping the ritual musical landscape of the region. The book includes case studies of men and women Sufi orders, Jewish and Black Tunisian healing practices, and the popular music across diverse socioeconomic classes. Jankowski concludes with a critical discussion of the popularization of Sufi ritual music and mass-mediated stage spectacles. Conceptually then, ambient Sufism, or the phrase ambient Sufism, is employed to illuminate diverse adjacent ritual practices that serve as musical, social, devotional, therapeutic niche, which exist within a broader fluid ecology of practices that orbit the figures of saints, especially Sufi saints. This book will be of interest to those who think and write on ethnomusicology, anthropology, Islamic and religious studies, and North African studies, while its accompanying website with audio and great video resources will be a great source to use in your courses, especially on ritual or Sufism and much more. In our conversation today, we spoke about the process of completing ethnography in Tunisia, some of the historical context of Islam and Sufism in Tunisia, the convergence of Jewish and Muslim adherents at Sufi shrines, the globalization of Sufi music, and the ways in which to use this text in a classroom, along with its accompanying website. So, without further ado, here's my conversation with Professor Richard C. Jankowski about his new book, Ambient Sufism, Ritual Niches, and the Social Work of Musical Form. Hi, Richard. Thank you so much for joining us to talk about your new book, Ambient Sufism, Ritual Niches, and the Social Work of Musical Form. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Of course, I'm very excited to talk to you about this fantastic work. As you may know, we have a tradition on the podcast to ask our guests to say a little bit about themselves and what led them to write this book and their intellectual journey. So I wonder if you could share that with us.
Yes, of course. There were a few sort of pivotal moments, I guess, I could draw attention to, because otherwise it would be a real lengthy linear narrative of my intellectual development. I guess as an undergraduate, I was an anthropology and music double major. And then I encountered the field of ethnomusicology, which effectively combines those two areas. And my first mentor in ethnomusicology was the West African music specialist, David Locke, who instilled in his students the value of patience in holding at bay our sort of Eurocentric and Americocentric questions and assumptions about musics of other cultures, and instead championed the importance of learning about those cultures and their musics on their own terms through participation and humility, really. So that was my introduction to ethnomusicology. After graduating, I moved to Tunisia for a little under 2 years. I studied Arabic intensively there and as a musician, sought out all that was musical. But at that point, music was still kind of secondary in terms of my career plans, as I had been planning to go into Middle East studies and perhaps a career in the diplomatic corps. But while I was in Tunis, I spent some time with the diplomatic community there, and I was really surprised by how little they actually interacted with citizens of their host country. And so I started to think I could work toward my goal, which was always wrapped up in the idea of fostering intercultural understanding, by doubling down on the study of music. I mean, that was where I was connecting the most with the people I encountered and came to befriend and respect and admire there. And, you know, in music, we often have the privilege of finding a kind of immediate and passionate common ground with others who we encounter in our journeys. So that shift of career ambition, if you will, was a pivotal moment, and it was reinforced by the large amount of time I had been spending at the Center for Maghreb Studies in Tunis, which was run by the late, great Jean Marad, who happened to be the mother of my undergraduate college roommate. So the Marad family were really influential. And she introduced me at the center to scholars at all levels of their careers, coming to Tunis to do research on such a diversity of topics from so many disciplinary perspectives. But there was a void in the cultural and musical approaches to scholarship that I was, you know, that I recognized and that I was energized to fill. So I entered the PhD program in ethnomusicology at the University of Chicago, where I studied under Martin Stokes and Philip Bowman, whose work inspired me in many ways, but especially I would say in how music, rather than, you know, the stereotypical idea that many people have of music being a kind of, you know, idealistic universal language that transcends difference and brings people together, actually is often a flashpoint for cultural and political debate, and is a site for managing issues of social difference. So I did another year of field work in Tunis and really became fascinated by musics that I encountered that were stigmatized socially, you know, musics that people didn't want to talk about, but they had this sort of respect for or even fear of. And you know, these were absent from local scholarship, yet just had, you know, clearly a profound and deep-rooted social power. And I was effectively taken in by a family of musicians who specialized in stambeli, which is a music-driven spirit possession ritual associated with Tunisians of sub-Saharan descent. And that would become my doctoral dissertation and the basis for my first book. Excuse me. And that book is an ethnography and a history of the stambeli ritual musical community. And it looks not only at how music interfaces with and creates the conditions for healing, but also how it creates a kind of alternative historiography of the slave trade across the Sahara, because those memories are embedded in the music and ritual, yet they've been suppressed in sort of official discourse, you know, and in school curricula. So that sort of provided the foundation or the jumping off point for this book, because stambeli is but one niche in a broader ecology that includes what I refer to as adjacent ritual practices. So this new book, Ambient Sufism, kind of steps back and takes a wider lens look at that ritual ecology, which is populated by distinct ritual communities associated with women Sufis, Black Tunisians, Jewish Tunisians, so-called ecstatic and sober Sufis, and even hard-drinking laborers. So that's the, I guess, the background to this project.
Yeah, I think the book is just such a great example of how, like, this focus on ritual practices and particularly music can really act as a prism for all of these other identities. And I found it just really rich, and I'm excited to talk about it with you a little bit more. As I was reading the book, I was really curious about, you know, what your methodological process was like. And I guess as an ethnographer, I would imagine myself, you know, it would consist of field work and being at sites. But I wonder what's a little bit different about being an ethnomusicologist. So what are some things that you would be looking for if you're in, you know, participating in ritual spaces or Sufi shrines as you do throughout the book?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, being an ethnomusicologist means, you know, not only developing the linguistic and social and cultural competencies, you know, required of, you know, long-term, deep field work, but also musical competencies. And in this case, that music is a very sort of specialized area. It's not the kind of thing you can go to a conservatory to study. It's so embedded in ritual practice that it also means entering into these ritual worlds. And I was very fortunate to have made contacts earlier in the earlier project in the Stambeli community and learn how to perform the music and take part in ritual in many different ways. And that really earned me a good reputation in the region, and it opened up doors to these other communities, because as I show in the book, they are really, even though each one is so incredibly distinct, when you hear, you know, certain sounds like the Gumbri lute, you know immediately that's Stambeli. If you hear the Mizwit bagpipes in the context of ritual, you know that immediately that is associated with the Jewish ritual healing tradition. So even though they're very, very distinct, they overlap in so many ways, and they have so many shared spiritual reference as well that, you know, I could early on, or let's say my experience with Stambeli ensured that I could speak sort of knowledgeably already about ritual and musics and the spiritual figures that are invoked. And in these ritual contexts, you know, one point I think is really important to make is that focusing on music can be super productive, because music is not something that accompanies ritual. In these contexts, music really is the ritual. It is the mechanism through which saints and spirits are summoned, and individuals who are participating follow their spiritual journeys. You know, music structures the entirety of the ceremony, and therefore, it's actually musicians who have this kind of maximal knowledge of those spiritual figures. And also the community, the members of the community who come, they know, you know, who needs to hear which song in order to be healed, and at which point in the ritual that song should come. And so, you know, I'm really hoping to center music a bit in the study of devotional and healing rituals in the region.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the title or the phrase ambient Sufism. You discuss it in your chapter one as kind of an important, I guess, intervention that you're making in the book. So what does ambient Sufism mean and what are you trying to get across in using that kind of focus?
Yeah, thanks. So I guess because Sufi saints are named and invoked in musics beyond what we might call formal Sufism, right? Or at least, you know, the stereotypical, you know, white woolen cloaked Sufis, although they are a present and a very important part of this ecology, they don't have a monopoly on the figures of and the spiritual interventions of Sufi saints. So you find, you know, many different ritual healing practices that have that invoke Sufi saints, but you also have working class drinking parties that actually have entire repertoires devoted to praising Sufi saints. You have concerts and all kinds of other projects. And so my approach is to have a very broad definition of Sufism, one that accounts for or captures a very wide variety of musical practices that call on Sufi saints. And because this wide variety of practices involves so many musical styles and so many contexts, the songs for Sufi saints circulate really widely. So that's part of the ambient part. You know, you hear these songs on TV during Ramadan. At just about every wedding that you'll ever go to has some of these songs. They're performed on some of the most prestigious theater and concert stages, as well as in, you know, those ritual ceremonies held at shrines, but also in domestic spaces. Every town has neighborhoods named after saints, and many town names themselves are simply names of saints. And, you know, these in turn evoke living practices associated with those spiritual figures. So that's really the ambient part. The saints are part of the atmosphere. You know, they're evoked through sounds, but they also prompt ideas and memories that may come and go, but are always within reach and readily available. So while many aspects of these practices are esoteric, that is, you know, the knowledge involved in them is only known to initiates, those things are performed very, very publicly. And so so that's really what I was getting at with the term ambient, this sense of, you know, the saints being always within reach, readily available, and, you know, just part of the general atmosphere.
And I think the Tunisian context is also important to set up here, right? Because as you say in the beginning and some of the chapters, I think the chapter two on women, there's a growing presence of kind of anti-Sufism or Salafi thought that's kind of resisting this broader ecology of saints and shrine practices. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a little bit about the Tunisian context for those who may not know about kind of the religious landscape that you're contending with and the place of Sufism within that landscape?
Yes, of course. So, you know, there are many Tunisians that I've that I know and that I've encountered throughout the many years I've spent researching and the culture of the region and living there, who describe their form of Islam as Sufi. You know, and that is not to say that everyone partakes in Sufi rituals. It's just that these figures of the saints provide certain models of of devotion. And it's a kind of decentralized, if you will, approach. And one that champions music and dance and processions and festivals and such. And in fact, you know, I was living in Tunisia when satellite dishes first started to become ubiquitous in the country. And when television programs from the Middle East, and particularly Saudi Arabia, started to be available in people's homes, a real debate emerged over, you know, the kind of, you know, Wahhabi-inspired messages that people were now having available to them and listening to on, you know, a daily basis. And so so there was a bit of sort of self assessment already going on in Tunisia in terms of you know, debates over what kind of Muslims are we. And of course, there's always a great deal of variety anyway, but two sort of camps started to emerge. And with the Arab Spring and the revolution of 2011, that really came to a head. You know, all was going well in my field work until that time. And the revolution ended Ben Ali's rule, introduced many democratic reforms, had very, you know, important and profound outcomes. But it also unleashed a variety of Islamist movements, and some of them violent. So the Sufi shrines that are neighborhood, you know, landmarks and emblems of community, where my field consultants and friends performed their ceremonies, were attacked. They were vandalized. Sometimes they were even occupied by Islamists. And so for the first couple of years after the revolution, the vast majority of the ritualists and musicians I was working with had to stop performing their ceremonies. And so Saint shrines and Sufi practices became even further enmeshed in these debates over, you know, the future of the country and the kind of Islam that would prevail. So at the time, the ritual communities and practices that I was studying were felt to be under serious threat. And my work certainly began for me to take on more urgency, as it was unclear whether I was witnessing their final chapter.
That's very interesting, especially as someone who does ethnography, that you, it's kind of scary to think that in a moment that your project becomes a memorialization or an archival project, because you just never know. And I think that's like it's interesting tension to deal with as a researcher in the field, and something that I've had to contend with as well. So it's fascinating to hear you say that. I wonder if we could talk now about some of the features of the book. And one of the things you do is you apply, you know, theory around music and ideas of how to approach these sonic landscapes and rituals that you're encountering. And you use words such as, or theory such as, timbre, texture, intensification. And I so appreciated this, because I, you know, I participate in Sufi rituals and study them, and I would have never known these to be approaches to study. I kind of think about ritual, Sufi rituals, in very different ways. So when you're encountering maybe like the trance practices or the hadras that you talk about in chapter two with Sufi communities, how do you look for these features in the ritual, such as the intensification process that you describe, or the texture or the form of the sounds that you're hearing? I don't know if that question makes sense.
No, it totally does. And you're right that this is, it's very unconventional what I'm doing, because conventional kind of musical or even sonic analysis tends to focus on, you know, melody and rhythm and, you know, things like that. And I really am so interested in looking at the ritual process from the perspective of the participant. So what are people experiencing? And there's kind of this long, or that process through any ritual is a long and holistic one. But moreover, it's a musical one in these contexts, and music creates that kind of architecture of time that, you know, or guides the participant along that trajectory, so they can take their journey, which is, you know, or the rehla, which is the common metaphor used in these contexts. And once I started doing that and, you know, stopped thinking about music in terms of, you know, pieces to be analyzed and just started thinking holistically about that journey, certain, you know, unexpected aspects of the musical experience started to emerge. And I think having that comparative approach, it's not really comparative, but this multi-sided approach, let's say, enabled me to, you know, to see what was unique to certain practices and what they had in common. And so, you know, it became very clear that timbre, for example, does an incredible amount of indexical work. So that is, it raises, you know, the sounds are raise immediate associations with particular ritual communities. So when the Jewish Rebbeia tradition, which uses the Mizwid bagpipes and the hand drums called bendir, they need to stick to that to create conditions for trance. That is sort of the baseline. But when they call on Stambeli saints or spirits, they actually add a Stambeli musical instrument called the shkashik, these handheld iron castanets, because it's so important in this ritual ecology, the way that, you know, musical and ritual logics work, to have that sound that is associated with and then evokes that, in, you know, that entire musical and ritual community. And so all of these sound very different, but what they have in common is when they have a timbre, you know, that, which is the quality of a sound, you know, that differentiates an instrument from another instrument. So when you hear, say, a B flat note, it's the same pitch, but if you played it on a piano or a tuba, you know which one is which, right? It's, so that's based on the so we call that timbre. So the distinctive quality of sound. But there are some other things that sort of evade our initial sort of analytical apparatus, if you will, because they seem so self-evident and not even worth, looking at explicitly. So constancy is another one. So constancy of timbre, unless you're doing something like the Rebbeia and, you know, trying to have a sort of Stambeli section, your timbre and texture remain constant. And that constancy, I think, is very important for creating the conditions for trance. But it also does something else. And I'm really interested in issues of repetition and constancy. And in these musics, that constancy rhythmically we would call cyclicity. So rather than calling it repetition, which suggests sort of unchanging sayings that are repeated over time, cyclicity is sort of an open-ended set of repetitions, but the concept also allows for certain variations to be made, because this isn't music where, although it might be described as repetitive, and certainly my students, when they first hear it, say, "Wow, that's really repetitive." And I'm like, "Yeah, but that's good. That's good if you're a trancer, right?" And also, where is it going? You know, this piece I'm playing for you is 6 minutes long. I'm not just going to play you a 10-second clip. I'm going to play the whole thing because it's going to bring you from point A to point B. And by the time you get to point B, you realize that the music has really intensified. And that's your journey if you're the trancer. It gets faster. There's more sonic density as you get faster. That is more sort of musical or sonic things happening per beat, if you will, or per second. It emerged from putting myself in the participants' perspective, or in the participants' shoes. Does that clarify? I'm hoping I'm not making things more confusing.
No, absolutely. And I think it also, because throughout your discussion, you also talk about in terms of if the participants are there from right at the start of the ritual, or if they should come halfway, and if does that, at all interfere with the full access. And I think you kind of get to this, particularly on the chapter around women in chapter three, where there is the need for healing, or people are attending because it's tied, the participation is tied to healing, right? Or there's aspects of a hospitality involved. And so I think hearing about the women's, the Tijani group or other Sufi groups that you are studying in this section, and how it's tying into larger Sufi rituals of hospitality, but particularly healing, also then kind of is getting at the point that you're making in terms of what is it that the participants are taking away from the ritual.
Right, exactly. And, so if you do take that example, say the women's Sufi group called the Manubia, revolving around the figure of the 13th century female saint, Seyda Manubia, in this practice, like the Rebbe Bia of the Jewish community and Stambeli of the Black Tunisian community, the whole ritual is structured around a large-scale musical form called the silsila. And the silsila literally means a chain. And it refers to a chain of songs played in a roughly standard order. And each song is associated with and is in praise of a specific Sufi saint or a possessing spirit. And I call this a cumulative musical form because as the musicians proceed through the silsila, through the chain, each song provides additional information, if you will, about that ritual community and its values and priorities. So they always begin, as most silsilas do, with a song for the prophet. But it's not just any song for the prophet. They begin with a song about the birth of the prophet with lyrics that emphasize the role of motherhood, right? The importance of motherhood. So it sort of signals, that this is a women's Sufi group, and the target audience and the participants are women. And then they move on in the second song to a song for Seyda Manubia, the group's namesake. And this song evokes the powers of this saint and, of course, situates her ritually in close proximity to the prophet. And it also evokes her peculiar history of challenging gender norms. I mean, there's some really powerful images that are described in the lyrics. And then the next song, they go and praise and invoke a male saint, Sidi Belhassen, who was Seyda Manoubia's teacher, Sufi teacher, despite the criticism she received for hanging out with, you know, male Sufis all night. And Sidi Belhassen is perhaps the most well-known saint in the area of Tunis. His shrine is sort of towers over the city on top of a hilltop. And the Shedulia Sufi order has him as their sort of founding namesake, because Sidi Belhassen is Sheduli. And they're considered the most conservative Sufi order in the region. They don't use any musical instruments. They don't partake in any outwardly visible forms of trance. Yet the figure of Sidi Belhassen is connected to Seyda Manoubia, and that connection is made musically and ritually here. So that's just the first three songs in this silsila, but with each one you kind of learn more. And for participants who are, you know, regular participants, they sort of have reinforced all of these things that are very specific to this particular ritual community. And I could say, go ahead. I was just going to say, and then, you know, the same could be said for the silsila of Stambeli, whose order of songs emphasizes African Islamic connections. You know, they also begin with the prophet, but the next song is for Sidi Bilal. Bilal was one of the prophet's companions who was the first caller to prayer in the history of Islam. He's a well-known historical figure. And then they move on to local Sufi saints that are of sub-Saharan origin and, you know, came to Tunisia as slaves and then had their saintness, I guess, their walaya, their closeness to God, recognized by Black and Arab Tunisians alike. And they entered into this sort of spiritual world where they are called upon to heal. And, you know, the further you go down that silsila, the more connections are made. So, so that's really what I mean by, or a couple of examples that illustrate this concept of the social work of musical form.
I just think even from each of the chapter, from your discussion of women in chapter 3 to the Stambeli ritual in chapter 4 and in chapter 5, where you look at the Muslim-Jewish convergence with the rabab, I just, even the discussion of the silsila there is really fascinating, because once you get to chapter 5 and you're kind of introducing us to the Jewish musicians who are participating in some of these rituals, the idea that the silsila for the Jewish musicians does not include the mention of the Prophet Muhammad, but starts in a different place. I just think that itself is fascinating to see how lineages are being created in particular mm-hmm. ritual contexts to appeal to maybe the actors and or the participants in that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's an example of, you know, the social work of musical form through the absence of... Mm-hmm. Of a spiritual figure, which, you know, you wouldn't pick up on unless you already knew how the silsila worked in these ritually adjacent practices. So then what's also very interesting is, okay, what replaced the nuba or the song for the prophet? And it ends up being, you know, a love song from the art music tradition called Melouf, and the song has origins in Libya. And so it opens up these historical connections, because there's actually very little there's no scholarship whatsoever on Rebbe Bia, this, now defunct, of course, the community no longer exists in Tunisia. But, you know, this trans-healing tradition of Jews on the mainland, you know, there on the island of Djerba, there is a Jewish community that, you know, has been studied by anthropologists and many ethnomusicologists in fact, but this trance healing tradition of the mainland had not been studied. And so looking at the music opens up these questions. Well, why this Libyan, you know, art music song? And so it compels you to start doing research in a previously unexpected realm of the history of Jewish migrations from, you know, neighboring countries. So yeah, it really is this this prism, to use a term you used earlier, that, you know, sheds light on and opens up paths into so many different realms of social and historical action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just so fascinating. I wonder if we could shift a little bit to talk about chapter 6, which is kind of the last chapter before the conclusion. And I think this is one of the chapters that I'm most interested in because I think a lot about the popularization of Sufi music and the contemporary yes. context. And I was really, really fascinated here about your discussion of this, I guess, in Tunisia and in other places as well, not only in Tunisia, but I think you also mentioned Morocco, where now there's these, you know, huge, I guess, concert-like or mm-hmm. showcases and performances of sacred Sufi music. And you use the phrase ritual and spectacle. And so there's now this, you know, shift between these kind of, you know, the ritual context in which some of these musical traditions that you're speaking about are being presented, and now kind of the performative spectacle aspect on, you know, the stage where these rituals are being displayed. And I think you ask some really, really fascinating questions here, and you really push, you know, the reader to think not very, you know, in a very textured way, actually, to think about how is Sufism on display and how is it being displayed. And you also talk about this idea of the desacralization of sound and the resacralization of public space, which I thought was so fascinating. So what do you think we need to think about when we think of the popularization of Sufi ritual music, not only in the Tunisian context, because I think this could really be applicable to a lot of other contexts as well.
Yeah, thanks so much. Yeah, what a wonderful reading of that chapter. I really appreciate the care you took. What I would say is, you know, we need to be careful of binaries such as, you know, authentic or inauthentic when it comes to staging any sacred sounds. These are contexts in their own right, and people get a lot of different things out of them, and they are really just filled with ambiguity. But what I tried to show in this chapter is that in the case of the spectacles in Tunisia, and I do hope, as you say, that there are ideas here that are transferable. Certainly, I'm not an expert in, you know, other parts of the world, but I have seen what appeared to be sort of family resemblances, that these ambiguities are actually very specific sets of ambiguities. And so, you know, you'll sometimes hear music that on the stage that sounds just like what you would hear in ritual, but it's a closing piece that's actually played at the beginning, or it's associated with sort of modern dance that, you know, includes, you know, martial arts like moves, you know, choreography, or it will involve, you know, one instrument that's, you know, not traditionally played in ritual. And so, and then there will be others where you take a song, but it's almost unrecognizable. It's originally from ritual, but it's played by a rock or a jazz band in a new arrangement. And these are all part of the same spectacle. So, you know, one of the tools I used, sort of an intellectual tool to grasp this was this concept of the contextual gap. And it draws on Briggs and Bauman's idea of the textual, intertextual gap from linguistic anthropology. And, you know, there are aspects of these spectacles where they stage Sufi music in which there are certain choices that are made that minimize that gap, that sort of try to recreate, in a sense, something that happens in ritual. And then there are others that really maximize that gap and draw attention to the fact that, hey, we're on a concert stage in a theater, so we're going to use all these, you know, all this innovative lighting and choreography and other things that are actually connected to the aesthetic, you know, logics and priorities of theater rather than ritual. And so I think that's kind of a flexible enough framework that it could be applied in different contexts. But I really appreciate that you saw that the value there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot about whirling dervishes in the North American context. So I think our geographical context is quite different. But I'm working on a project on kind of the popularization of it. And I think a lot of the questions that I get, which is exactly, I think, what you were engaging with here, is this like loss of authenticity, right? Kind of this binary of, is this authentic or not authentic? And it's hard because when I interview the actual samizans or the whirlers on stage, they're having what seems, at least you're describing to me, a very real experience that's comparable to what they might experience in an actual more private ritual context. But I think, you know, maybe the exchange of money, as you say, maybe the lights, the stage, you know, the idea that it becomes a spectacle for some people feels like it's, a dilution or something is being taken away that makes it less authentic. So as I was reading this and the questions and the way that you kind of carefully asked the reader to not enter that binary, but actually consider the intertextual, I thought was really productive, at least for me. So I appreciated the chapter.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you. I look forward to talking, you know, more with you about that project. I think that's fascinating.
Oh, thanks. I wonder if we could take a step back. I mean, there's so much detail in this book, and this is only meant to be an introduction, but is there, you know, a key point or a couple of key points that you want the reader to take away as a whole in this book as they're thinking about it?
Well, that's a great idea. We just got down into the weeds, and maybe now we'll...
look up a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, we'll...
You mention it in terms of authority and the role of ritual spaces, and you invoke Shahab Ahmed as well in terms of kind of thinking about what could be constituted as Islamic, right? I think that was one idea that I thought of as I was reading the conclusion.
Oh, yes, absolutely. This idea, you know, that the late great Shahab Ahmed left us with the concept of explorative authority in Islam just rings so true when working in ritual contexts in Tunisia and across North Africa, you know, other places I've been as well. And, you know, unfortunately, it feels like an uphill battle against, you know, the urge or the expectation that, you know, we look at, you know, the kind of prescriptive authority, the authority, you know, that resides in the interpretation of texts. So yeah, that's absolutely a really important kind of takeaway from the book. I would, if we step back even further, I might say that, you know, particularly because, you know, maybe your audience is not, you know, will be made up of people who are not often reading, you know, scholarly books in music or ethnomusicology to sort of find, to sort of explore Islamic studies, I would say that the musical and the social in this book are two sides of the same coin. And so in order to understand the social, I argue that we need to understand certain musical aspects. And in order to really get at the music and why it's structured the way it is, we need to understand the social work that it accomplishes. So, one of the main takeaways is that these two things are inseparable in the context of devotional and healing ritual musics. And I guess going a step further, those ritual musics are, shaped by, performed by, women and minorities and so-called ecstatic Sufis, and they all really play an important role in contributing to the definition of and the circulation of, Sufi music or musics associated with Sufism in Tunisia, and again, by extension, much of North Africa, since similar exercises in neighboring countries, might yield similar pictures.
Mm-hmm. I should also tell our listeners that the book comes with a compendium website, which has fantastic, fantastic audio files and video clips, and it's organized according to each chapter. I'm really grateful for you that you've done this. And do you have any suggestions, perhaps, for some of our listeners who maybe teach courses that they could incorporate both sections of the book or the entirety of the book with parts or audio files or video files from the website that you put together for us?
Oh yeah, for sure. And thank you for bringing that up. And I want to give a shout out to the wonderful people at Tufts Digital Library who were able to build this website and populate it with so many field recordings that illustrate specific musical points I make in the book. The website is organized according to chapter. It provides audio and video examples for each of them. I do want to say that most of these are field recordings that I made in the context of actual ceremonies. And I used a very simple stereo microphone setup and placed the microphone close to where the dancer would be, or the trancer, or other participants, in order to best approximate or capture the ritual experience of participants. So I think it's an important point to make, because I purposefully avoided trying to clean up the sound or add microphones closer to the mouths of singers. And so for users of the website who are accustomed, to slickly recorded productions, it might take a little recalibration of expectations, which I think is good, because to return, full circle to the point of, the importance of approaching other musics and cultures on their own terms, it's good to start with some humility and put our, not sort of try to make a studio recording according to, our expected Spotify, aesthetics. I wanted to capture that experience. But then some of the others are, are pulled from YouTube or are pulled from, concert performances and are not mine. But in terms of using the website to teach, this book, because it's made up of a series of fairly self-contained case studies, I think can be used in a wide variety of classes. If you're interested in women Sufis, there's a chapter that you know, addresses that and only that. If you're interested in, you know, ritual musics and minorities, there are a couple of chapters that deal explicitly with that. And I do think it is important to, in order to get a sense of what it's like to be there, to feel comfortable letting the audio or video examples play. Sometimes in our classrooms, you know, once a minute has gone by, the you can almost feel the awkwardness in the room as students are like unsure of how they should be reacting now. And so I do my best to prepare them for that. But I do think it's important because a lot of the things that I draw attention to are kind of long-term or larger scale. And so getting from point A to point B can sometimes take a little bit of time, but is, you know, usually worth the wait.
I really appreciated that note that you mentioned that, you know, just don't play it for a minute, but play the whole bit and let the students sit with it. Because I think, yes, what you just said completely resonates with me, that you feel like maybe they're not receiving it and you just want to stop and move on. But I think I'll have to keep that in mind when I'm trying to incorporate some of this as well. The website was fantastic, and partly because I'm not so musically inclined. So it was great for me as I was going through the different chapters just to go to the website and play. And so I had a point of reference mentally. So I really, really appreciate the website and I think it's fantastic. I'm mindful of our time and I've taken up so much of your time already. As a traditional last question, I wonder what are some things that you may be working on now? I realize we're in a pandemic and things are very different, but perhaps there was a project that you're working on that's on pause or maybe an idea that's floating around. I'm sure some of our listeners would love to know.
Oh, sure. Well, I have a couple that I'm working on. I mean, right now I'm actually finishing up another book manuscript that takes an even broader look across the Maghreb, so across, you know, North Africa. Looking at music, politics, and power in the region. So I have chapters on hip-hop and the Arab Spring, music and the Amazigh or Berber rights movements in Algeria and Morocco. Other case studies of music and migration and minorities. Migration including rural to urban internal migration that led to so many popular musics in the region that were controversial and stigmatized. You know, Algerian Rai is perhaps the best known example because it made its way into the world music market. But Tunisia and Morocco and to a certain extent Libya also have similar experiences. So I'm excited about that one. And, you know, the pandemic actually led me to start doing some other things and returning to, you know, aspects of music that are formative in my personal biography. And so I'm a jazz musician. That's how I started. And I've always been fascinated by the not just the musical, but the social value attributed to certain drum set symbols that were made in Turkey in the 1950s and 60s. And then those companies moved to the U.S., but then as part of this demand, companies in Turkey that were connected in some way to those original production lines in Turkey in the 1950s and 60s started sprouting up there. So I've got this kind of, I don't know, critical organology project where organology is a study of musical instruments, but really looking at the social and historical lives of musical instruments.
That is so cool. That's amazing. I really look forward to your work and I've learned so much. So I'm so thankful to you for spending the time with us and sharing insights about this new fantastic book. Thank you so much again.
Well, thank you for having me.
And that was my conversation with Dr. Richard C. Jankowski about his new book, Ambient Sufism, Ritual Niches and the Social Work of Musical Form, published with the University of Chicago Press in 2021. I hope you enjoyed our conversation, and I look forward to having you join me again next time on the New Books in Islamic Studies. Until then, take care and stay well.